Okay, I'll just do if I may, a very brief introduction because I missed the first two classes. It's a pleasure to have Rabbi Dr. Zev Elef back. He's spoken a few times in the past, really needs no introduction. A very prolific author, books and articles. And if you haven't read his book on, I guess, on American modern orthodoxy, I
Oh,
highly
yeah,
recommend it. But
oh
all kinds of interesting articles and
my
president of Bretz College. And I really want to thank him for giving this series on adventures in American history. And Bakasha, that's all I have to say. It's all yours.
God. And welcome for part three.
Hold on, Zeb. Did you just hear my introduction, or I was muted?
No, we heard you.
Oh, you heard me. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, go on.
Welcome to part three. I've tried in our adventures in American Judaism to traipse through, not just first of all New York, certainly, but also through time and through religious proclivities. So, where we've been so far, we've looked at the transformation of the rabbinate, which was really a transformation of religious culture inside and outside of the synagogue. Last week, we looked at the parting of the ways, something that my teacher, Jonathan Klarna, and Mike Cohn, a colleague of mine, have written about. And I tried my best to show how it wasn't one group moving away from the other, as some scholars have positioned it, but really a conservative and Orthodox Judaism finding definition by reacting to one another. Today, I want to look at Orthodox Judaism. In our fourth installment, we'll look at Reform Judaism, particularly around patrilineal descent in the last quarter of the 20th century. But I am excited to share with you today. And I want to make sure I optimize sound also, because I do have some sound to share. So just like last week, I argued that the arrival of Solomon Schachter to the United States in 1902 was a pivotal moment. Some 39 years later, in February 1941, the Orthodox Youth, a short-lived publication by the nascent Agudas Yisrael of America, has a banner headline, Rabbi Aaron Cutler, on way to Japan. He would arrive in San Francisco just before Passover Pesach in 1941. Rabbi Aaron Cutler was a genius. He was the at very young age, 21 years old, was the Rosh Yeshiva of Slutsk, but eventually moved away from his father-in-law's yeshiva. His father-in-law was Rabbi Isser Zalman Meltzer. He would create his own yeshiva in Kletsk. With a small cadre of students, he would stay open for quite some time in Kletsk, but eventually, he was strongly persuaded that the yeshiva could not survive in, amidst World War II. And he would have to travel and relocate that yeshiva to the United States. Before I get to not just a myth, but it actually certainly did happen, I want to understand sort of the culture of the so-called yeshiva world in the United States. Rabbi Moshe Yosher was the first biographer. He lived in Brooklyn. He was the first biographer of the Chafetz Chaim, and he offers the following: L'magenet lev nimnu hagdolim. Hamanhigim lahakshir ba'open ma'asi et asher chaza me'rosh hagon hador Reb Chaim mivolozhin lifnei ma'al lemala mi'mei shana. Unfortunately, I give you the Yiddish, the Hebrew, and the English. I'll translate on my own, but I give you the English below. Unfortunately, the Orthodox leadership have not paid heed to the legend surrounding Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, who founded, to your right, you see it, Yeshiva Eitz Chaim Yeshiva in Volozhin in 1802. Ki America, that means America, tahapoch lemerkaz shel Yahadut, that Reb Chaim of Volozhin anticipated that America would transform into a center of Judaism, v'chi ha-Torah timsa ba'America et Ach Zanita Ketachana Achrona Shel Esar Golio, to play off of a piece of Agada in the Talmud in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, Shalala Avor Lifnei Hamasur. There is this tradition, there will be 10 stops of the Torah before the Messianic redemption. And they have, according to Moshe Yosher, already trespassed through the following: Babel, Africa, China, Egypt, Italia, Italy. All these places, by the way, you could travel with Jay. Adore and Moshe, I imagine. Sarfat, Ashkenaz, Poland, Lolita, Yala, the Gorala, Shal, America. And in the 10th installment, not Canada, but America, Liyot, Achzanita, Umerkaz, Achronim, Torah. It was anticipated that Torah would travel to the United States just before reaching the Messiah, Mashiach. And in fact, whether he said it or not, this was very much an ether. There's actually a good reason to suppose that Rabbi Chaim Blazer did anticipate and predict this and said it out loud in the age of Jackson, in the early 19th century. But we know for certain, because we have it in the archives of the Agudas Yisrael, that Rabbi Aaron Cutler, upon a touchdown in the ports of San Francisco, explained to the delegation that greeted him there that I am the fulfillment, said he, of Rabbi Chaim of Luzhner's vision. I represent that Torah will in fact have a station here in the United States. There's more to it. Rabbi Chaim of Luzhner, in the earliest incarnation, was said to have cried. It was understood in the first retellings of it in the early 20th century that crying, that weeping over Torah traveling to America had to do with all the assimilation, that how hard it would be for Torah observant Judaism, however one might classify that, to solidify, to fortify itself here in the United States. You'll see in a moment that the crying changed. It had a very much a Holocaust, bent. You'll see to it. So here is an audio. I think you will all be able to hear it from another Rosh Hashiva, from the next generation of Rosh Hashiva in the United States, Rabbi Mordechai Gifter. Before I get that, let me, here's what Rabbi Aaron Cutler said. Motelat aleinu achova laso k'chol yecholotenu. This is what, Rabbi Aaron Cutler, descending on the West Coast, he would travel to New York in 1941. He would build the Lakewood Yeshiva, Beis Medrash Gavoa of Lakewood, in 1943. Sorry, move these Zoom controls so I can read it. Nothing's different. I built Kletsk in Eastern Europe, and I'm going to build my yeshiva. I'm going to help rebuild Torah in the United States in exact measure for measure. It's not going to look any different. The United States has nothing to do with it. I am not looking to synergize. I am not looking to acculturate my Torah to the United States, offers Rabbi Aaron Cutler. I am going to rebuild the yeshiva world as it was in Europe, exactly measure for measure as it was in the United States. And this is something that all of you, said Rabbi Cutler, are going to help me. And what's my proof that you're going to help me? Because I am the fulfillment. Everybody knows what is said in the name of Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, Zecher Tzadik Lebracha, on the Didat HaTorah, the Eser Achsaniot, Ad Ba'o Shal Mashiach Zekenu. What he said about the 10 travails, 10 stops of the Torah before the oncoming of the Messiah, Bachaneha Achrona, and the last station will be to, yeah, America. I am, said Rabbi Cutler, 1941, just before Passover. I am the fulfillment of that 150-year-old vision.
Is there any evidence that Reb Chaim Volozhin really said that, or is it an apocryphal opinion?
Good question. The earliest source that I ever found of it is Rabbi Moshe Yosher. So Rabbi Moshe Yosher publishes in Yiddish in the 1930s, so it's about 110 years later. So one can be skeptical of that. In the mid-70s, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik delivered this. He liked to do this. A number Rabbi. It's interesting. Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik was the younger. He hated to be known like this. The younger brother of the Rav, of Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. The Rav, I have never found any evidence that he ever told this myth. But Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik liked it quite a bit. They grew up differently in different times. Rabbi Aaron was much younger than his older brother, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik. And so he heard stories differently. The way that he told it is that it was Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik would tell over the story. It's a good fundraising pitch to build a yeshiva, after all. He heard it from his father, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, who told it over at his bar mitzvah. And Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik heard it. This is again from Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik at his bar mitzvah, from the Nitziv, Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was a part of the Beis Harav, part of the early family of Rabbi Chaim Lubavitch. So I can tell you that that is probably the strongest source that we know from somebody, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, that he heard it only two steps removed. We do not have it from the pen of Rabbi Chaim Lubavitch. The reason why I think that, and again, I'm not interested in the myth so much about how it's used. And by myth, I don't try to denigrate it as something true or not. It's just more interesting to me how that story has been told over time. I've written a big article about it. What's interesting is that in the hashkafa or the theology of Rabbi Chaim Lubavitch, he believed in Nefesh HaChaim, which he did write, certainly, that he wrote that Torah needs to be recited at all times, or else the world, this is what he writes in the fourth section of his Nefesh HaChaim, will revert to nothingness. And so if you don't have Torah at all times, then the world cannot sustain itself, thought Rabbi Chaim Lubavitch. So it would stand to reason that he might also consider that at the beginning of the 19th century, that Torah needs to be in all places. And knowing that the new world was all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but was truly on people's map, as a civilization, it would make sense that the same person who thought Torah needs to be recited at all times also needs to be recited and articulated in all places. So, take that as you will. It's a good question. We haven't found the smoking gun beyond it, but that's what I can give you in terms of the veracity of testing, the sort of the historicity. Historians like to make up words, historicity, of this story.
That's a fascinating theory, because there's also a theory that Columbus looked for the new world, because according to the Mizmor, the one Mizmor that we say on Shabbat, God has to be in all countries in the world for the Mashiach to come.
Columbus was interested in a different Messiah. Right, there were thoughts in the 400th anniversary of Columbus' expedition that to make him into a Jew. There was actually financiers, American Jews, who paid historians to publish this. My teacher Jonathan Stein has written a number of articles about this. So there's all sorts of Jews, in all places. It's not unique to just Jews. All newcomers try to establish themselves as part of the foundational mythos of a culture. So Jews, if the 10 lost tribes were the Native Americans, or if Columbus or members of his crew were Jewish, or if Chaim Solomon played an outsized role in financing the American Revolution, Jews gain a stronger foothold to it. And if Rabbi Chaim Lubavitch had truly anticipated in the age of Jefferson and Jackson that Torah would have to travel here, it makes America that much more agreeable for Jewish life. That's really what I'm headed.
It really doesn't matter whether Reb Chaim Vloshin himself made that prediction. It's clear from what you say that it was believed in the Gedolim from Lithuania
Right.
at the time.
So we'll see, though. His crying, though, takes on a different feel. So let's take a look at it. Already there's comments about Rav Gifter's relation. So here's Rav Gifter. Rav Gifter was somebody who had very strong opinions and articulated them quite forcefully. So here is an audio from the late 80s from Rav Mordechai Gifter. Well, he'll speak for himself.
And I keep telling the story that the Chaim Volozhinov, the first and great yeshiva of Lithuanian Polish Jewry, once burst out crying, "The last station for Torah before the coming of Mashiach will be the United States of America." And one of his great disciples asked him, "So why does the Rebbe cry? What's there to cry about?" His answer was, "I see how bitter it will be to create this last nation." No one understood what he's talking about, what he was talking about. When Hitler came along, we began to understand what Reb Chaim Volozhinov had in mind.
Just to make sure, was that come through? Everybody heard it? Good, okay. All right, quite startling. Certainly, the cries, therefore, are not about assimilation. It's about the destruction of European Jewry. And that's important. That if the cries, if the tearing up, the weeping of Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin in anticipating Torah would have to travel to the United States, if it's crying about the heartbreak and the struggle to establish Torah in the United States, then America, the United States, becomes a part of the project to rebuild Torah in the New World. If the tears are about the destruction of European Jewry at the hands of Hitler, Yimach Shemo v'Zichro, then it's not really about the United States at all. The United States is simply a carrier of Torah, which was furnished, which was cultivated in the fertile soil of Europe. It's only a matter of tilling the soil here, manipulating it so that Torah could come to the United States, but really in a European hue. That makes sense? So there is a nafka mina, so to speak. There is a practical difference in why Rabbi Chaim Volozhinov cries. Is he crying because it's going to be a struggle to make America amenable to a Torah environment, to a Orthodox environment? Or is he crying because European Jewry is going to have to plummet for Torah to take place here in the United States? And Rabbi Aaron Cutler, even though certainly there were Torah centers here in the United States, we looked at the precursors to what we now call Yeshiva University. There was the Rabbi Jacob Joseph Yeshiva, named after the chief rabbi who we explored a little bit earlier. There was Torah Badas. There was the Chicago Yeshiva. He was the law college on the Skokie Yeshiva. But Rav Aaron Cutler really saw himself as a pioneer and a negation of those institutions. Now, I'll read you the English here, giving you the Hebrew as well. It should be said very clearly before this gathering of yeshiva students a word about the terrible mistake of splitting one's day for college studies. So he's reacting in the 1950s about the tendency for people, this is after the GI Bill, all of a sudden colleges are becoming much more in vogue. "This is a terrible and fearful thing. Apart from the deficiencies caused in Torah study and the diminishing of genuine Torah scholars among Israel, how will we raise someone like the Brisker Rav who divide some of their time and talents to external studies?" He's railing. He's railing against the, which is du jour, which is, as Jews are rising from working to middle class, they are offering their children college education. I'm sure many of you have relatives who studied for free or close to it at City College. Certainly, Yeshiva College was founded at this time. And he is of the mind that a true yeshiva student should take risks, financial risks certainly, and avoid studying college because the purpose of a yeshiva is to build Torah scout. Now,
is he polemicizing against the Rav who was at Yeshiva University at the time?
I don't think explicitly. I think that Rav Aaron Cutler dies in 1962. And so that means that Yeshiva University, while a major yeshiva, still its ranks won't skyrocket. Its numbers won't skyrocket until the Vietnam War. And so the visibility of yeshiva and also they had a very deep friendship. It would not, I showed last week the famous Psak Din, as it's called, the 11 Rosh Yeshiva who proscribe any interaction between Orthodox and the non-Orthodox. Certainly that started to fray their relationship. I believe the speech was delivered before then, so it's not particularly attacking the Rav. After all, he was looking at Chaim Berlin and Torah Das, in which many of its students would attend the evening program at Brooklyn College. So he's not just looking at it that way. At yeshiva with the integrated model of the one-stop shop, but he's looking at an ecosystem in the yeshiva world in which most students, even back Lakewood students, would attend college, not during their studies, but directly afterward. So Rav Aaron Cutler was really not in the main at this point, and I don't think he has the Rav particularly in his crosshairs. It's a good question. In another speech in this generation after the European Holocaust, when the centers of Torah were destroyed, very much anticipating how Rav Gifter recast the story of Rav Chaim of Volozhin, when the centers of Torah were destroyed and the world remained desolate, it is the great role of the Jews of the United States and Israel, so Israel's a part of it certainly, to build atop the ruins and replant through that spirit, to establish fortresses for Torah and the God-fearing, and to create an atmosphere of devotion to Torah and faith in its holiness and eternity without engaging in extraneous and outside labors. Only through this atmosphere it is possible to raise a generation of complete Torah scholars steeped in Torah and spirit. In fact, in the biography, I have it here, of Rabbi Aaron Cutler, there's an art scroll biography. I don't know exactly where not. There's a Feldheim, I believe, is the publisher of a biography. It's called The Living Mishnas Rabbi Aaron or something that way, which is the name of his collected writings, Mishnat Rabbi Aaron. There's a story in a footnote, I believe, that a man approached Rabbi Aaron Cutler and said, my son has been, well, see, there's a hand raised, so I'll stop screen for a moment. Let's finish with the story, is that an older gentleman approached Rabbi Aaron Cutler and said, Rabbi Aaron, I need a favor. My son needs to be released from the yeshiva. I'm told he's a good guy, but he's not the best. He's not one of your great, most brilliant students. He can't hack it anymore. He needs to go and get a job. And the way this biography tells it, it tells it as if it's something to be proud of. I leave it to your judgment one way or the other. Rav Aaron Cutler responded, sorry, your son needs to stay here. There needs to be foot soldiers in support of my mission and my war on behalf of Torah, that your son is a sacrifice to make sure that we grow with a critical mass so we can rebuild Torah in the United States, whether he ends up trying, you know, whatever profession it is, that's clearly under your expectation. Rav Aaron Cutler had this militant understanding of his quest to rebuild Torah in the United States. Yochabed, you have your hand up.
Okay, I remember hearing, I don't know if this is an apocryphal story, I think my son may have told this to me, that at one point in Europe, Rav Aaron Cutler was being encouraged to attend college himself, I believe maybe by his sister, who was more assimilated or whatever, acculturated, shall we say. But the story goes that he was literally in the wagon on the way, and then he just turned around and went back. Or just, does this ring a bell with you? Or
I don't know the story.
Okay, no, so I'm going to try to authenticate it then. Okay.
Yeah, I'd love to see it, yeah.
And one quick question. All these shared screens are included in the handouts on Torah in Motion.
I think Jay had reprimanded me that I did not send it last week, but certainly I will happily
share it. In case I don't get every, you know, every detail and I want to look at it again. Okay.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. Okay.
Oh, wow. Shelley.
Under your second thing of why the Rabbi of Elojin is crying, is seeing the destruction of the of European Jewry. If that is the interpretation, then why were the rabbis in the mid and late 1800s, beginning of 1900s, so dead set against anybody being from going to America? Couldn't they see the handwriting on the wall? I mean, if you go by that interpretation, then they could have done the same thing that they had to do after the war in the beginning, and they would have saved a lot of lives. And even if some people weren't religious, they would have saved lives.
And so it's great. That is precisely the context of Rabbi Moshe Yosher's the selection that I provided from him. It is a critique of the rabbinic and lay leaders at the turn of the 20th century that advised against migrating to the United States. They should have adhered to the increasingly better known wisdom of the vision of Reb Chaim of Elojin. It's exactly his point to that. And the Chavetz Chaim wrote a two-volume work called Nidchei Yisrael, which discouraged migration to the United States. And Rabbi Moshe Yosher apologetically was of the opinion that had the Chavetz Chaim, who dies in 1933, known about the situation both in Europe and the United States toward the mid-20th century, he would have thought differently. Can't prove one way or the other. Somebody labeled iPad Toronto, and then we'll continue on.
Okay, I just have some reservations about predictions. Because while the prediction, he could have said it, but it without context, meaning tell me all the predictions he said and tell me how many of them actually came true. Just to pick, you know, selectively, he said this and it came true. If you tell me that's the only thing he ever predicted, then I might be impressed. If you tell me he predicted Secretariat would lose the Triple Crown, I'm not as impressed. You know what I mean? It has to be.
I know what you mean. And so I'm not, first of all, so historians make for very poor prophets. So I'm with you on this one. I'm less interested in all the different predictions. There were several, I don't know, that Rabbi Chaim of Elojin offered in his lifetime I'm much more interested in how the story is used over a period of time.
Okay, so but I'm just saying the prediction is meaningless without context, at least for God's
sake. No, the prediction is, but I'm not there. I'm on that. You're on the first derivative. So in mathematical terms, I'm in the second derivative of not testing the authenticity or the veracity of the story. I'm interested how the story is used by historical actors over a period of time.
Okay. And then the other comment I have, and I see Jay, Rabbi Jay is here, is when somebody tells me that they don't want to change orthodoxy from Europe to America, and we know that in Europe, when the choice was Judaism or Christianity, we chose as a people Judaism because Christianity was right. But when the choice was Judaism or secularism, the majority of Jews left Judaism because it had no legitimate appeal for them. It didn't affect their lives. It hindered them in many ways. So to say, I want to keep that religion that most of my fellow Jews abandoned when they had a viable choice is to me problematic also.
All right. Loud and clear. Loud and clear. I just report the news. Very, very late. Take a look, though, in context. This is, and Ron Cutler being so dedicated to the proposition that Orthodox Judaism can only flourish with centers of education. This is a chart based on the Torah Masorah history by Rabbi Daniel Kramer. This quote is Rabbi Daniel Kramer. These were numbers that I piped in based on various still important work by Alvin Schick. Rabbi Cutler was to be the diadem of Torah Mesorah. That was an organization founded in the mid-1940s to establish Jewish Orthodox day schools in the United States, along the American hinterland, so to speak. It should be the fact that he gave not only his endorsement, but also his own time and effort emphasized its special mission during the 18 years that he served as the spiritual authority of Torah Mesorah until his death in 1962. The organization saw its greatest growth. Not only was he concerned with the quantitative increase of day schools, but he spurred educational and qualitative improvements as well. And so here you have the number of total enrolled day school students in the United States from 1917, where it was basically zero. The so-called day school movement in the United States takes place between 1945 and 1965, and you see by the numbers how they shot up so drastically during that time, coinciding with the arrival of Rabbi Aaron Cutler. Take a look in 1965. These are the enrollment numbers also in the Alvin Schiff book, Day Schools in America, or Jewish Education in America. Here you have it that Yeshiva University has the largest enrollment of any yeshiva. Torah Yira is Satmar. Torah V'Das has basically half what yeshiva has. Mir in Brooklyn. The Spanish Gavoa is a small yeshiva at that time. Chaim Berlin, Ner Yisrael in Baltimore. Tells in Cleveland, which is a Gifter's yeshiva. Tokhle Tzmimim is Chabad. Hebrew Theological College is the Chicago yeshiva. Tiferet Yishlaim is Rav Moshe Feinstein's yeshiva in the lower Eastside. Chametz Chaim is migrating between Queens and Brooklyn at the time. Here is official numbers from BMG, from Beis Medrash Gavoa, up till 2005. You'll see it's quite interesting. When they look at when they count their numbers in Lakewood, they don't begin in 1943 when the yeshiva was formally established there, but because it is the yeshiva is a continuation of Klesk. It actually, they count their enrollment from 1923. And you see there's this interregnum between 1939 and 1943 in which they have zero students. You can see how it skyrockets, not during the lifetime of Rabbi Aaron Cutler. If you see my cursor, he dies right here, 1962. But during the leadership of Rabbi Schneer Cutler, his son. And it really picks up moving forward that, and it's just today it has some 6,000, 7,000, 8,000. Students in its yeshiva and its kollel. It's not just for the men, but yeshiva day schools, Orthodox day schools, make a very, place a very sturdy bet with women as well. I'll thank my wonderful friend and colleague, Leslie Ginsberg Klein, for these materials. She's publishing a book, hopefully, on the history of Beis Yaakov in the United States very, very shortly. And these are her notes. Vishna Kaplan, who is a student of Sarah Schneer, is the Johnny Appleseed, so to speak, of the Beis Yaakov movement in the United States. And here in the highlighted section, you can see that you can read for yourself, and I'll make sure that we have the slides for her vision of the blossoming of women's education, through a particular vantage point, of course, through a certain variation. You also see on the bottom left, it was really important. If not for Beis Yaakov, Lakewood Yeshiva could never have succeeded, according attributed to Rabbi Aaron Cutler. Want to zoom out for a second. And as we look at the legacy of Rabbi Aaron Cutler, 1979, that's Peter Berger, a very important social thinker. But he offers the following, the first chapter of his heretical imperative in 1979. Yet those who affirm an Orthodox or even moderately Orthodox version of Jewish identity, this book is not about Judaism, Orthodox Judaism, but religion in America, continue to define the latter as such a fact. The problem is that, and I'll explain them when I'm done, is that they must affirm it in the face of empirical evidence to the contrary. What does he mean? The Orthodox precisely defines Jewish identity as destiny, while the social experience of the individual reveals it is as an ongoing choice. The dissonance between definition and experience is at the core of every Orthodoxy in the modern world. The Orthodox defines himself as living in a tradition. It is of the very nature of tradition to be taken for granted. This taken for grantedness, however, is continually falsified by the experience of living in a modern society. The Orthodox must then present to himself as fate what he knows empirically to be a choice. This is a difficult feat. In other words, what's he really saying? Is that Peter Berger is using Orthodox Judaism as an example as a type of faith that doesn't have much of a future in the United States. He actually wrote towards the end of his life that he regretted this paragraph. But he anticipates that in, by the late 1970s, Orthodox Judaism that looks at itself as being fated as part of a destiny is fooling itself here in the modern world. Modern techno world is defined by choice. And he is right about this, is that no matter however we believe, we wake up every single morning reconfirming that belief. Nobody, in other words, is forcing anybody to believe in a particular doctrine. To the contrary, what does Berger suggest? That every single morning, one way, if you're an Orthodox Jew, Servant Jew, Reform Jew, whatever, it doesn't matter, you wake up and you reaffirm your beliefs and you carry on, you do it again the next day. Nobody is coercing you to behave in a certain way. And he suggests, Berger, that in a modern world of choices, of contingencies, the odds that somebody will wake up every single morning and reaffirm an orthodoxy, lowercase o, has no real assurance and no real basis to survive over the long haul. Berger eventually, I believe in a book written toward the end of his life, only passed away a few years ago, points out that he really underestimated the role of rabbinic authority in certain sectors of Orthodox Judaism. 1963, after the passing of Cutler, the Jewish Observer is formed as a monthly magazine by the Agudas Yisrael, and he offers in it one of the first issues looks at this idea of Das Torah, of rabbinic authority, rabbinic infallibility. One could talk about it for a long, long time, but suffice it to say is that Das Torah is the notion, the belief that in this extra halachic powers of rabbinic leadership to determine a path forward that should go uncontested. At this point, allow me to take issue with the editor of the Jewish Observer for airing to the press areas of jurisdiction which the layman has no authority to voice an opinion. This area of hashkafa and guidance in Jewish life has always been the sacred domain of the gedolim, meaning great ones, the great rabbis. To allow laymen or even rabbis who have not yet attained great heights in Torah, they have not reached the requisite levels for Das Torah, to publicly suggest or state that the Rosh Yeshiva are neglecting or overlooking obvious areas in the jurisdiction is presumptuous, in bad taste, and out of line for a publication speaking in the name of Gedolim. See, apparently the Jewish Observer was guilty of this. I have often wondered if the Jewish Observer is subject to review before publication. So same magazine which also promulgated the idea of Das Torah and the view of the infallibility of Gedolim was also subject to sometimes being criticized for not having a sufficient amount of this. By a gadol or a group of gadolim, without such direction scrutiny, the public has no assurance that the views expressed, especially when written by laymen, are indeed those of the gadolim, said some anonymous person in St. Louis, Missouri. One of the most interesting articulations of Das Torah, which Rav Aaron Cutler writes about in his commentary, in his collected writings, the Mishnas Rabbi Aaron, but certainly it is part of a culture, a milieu that he espouses and fortifies for generations to come in the United States. One of the earliest articulations of this is by Rabbi Abraham J. Torsky. He was a celebrated psychologist and rabbinic leader. Read along with me here. We'll take questions probably at the end, but we'll make time for it certainly. Although a rabbi may be authorized to issue rulings on questions that can be answered by halacha, that does not necessarily qualify him to render an opinion on matters for which there are no direct halachic guidelines. In such cases, one should be guided exclusively by Torah Hashkafa. There are principles of Torah Hashkafa that can, now again, I'm not offering this a pasha, I'm just reading, I'm just reporting the news. Late. There are principles of Torah Hashkafa that can serve as guidelines for all situations in life. However, a person giving an opinion must be certain that his opinion is based on pure Torah concepts. This could be done only by someone whose entire thought processes are the result of Torah knowledge. I have studied psychology, offers Rabbi Dr. Tversky, and it is possible that my thinking may have been influenced by my secular studies, suggests Rabbi Tversky quite humbly. I'm certainly a Talmud Chacham, I'm a smart person, but I've also injured the purity of my Torah studies by studying advanced psychology. Even if I had adequate Torah knowledge, I could not be considered Das Torah because I have been subject to concepts that did not derive from Torah. Therefore, Das Torah is a Talmud Chacham who was never influenced by anything other than Torah. Interesting idea. Which explains why in the late 70s, there was so much backlash in the yeshiva world to notions like psychotherapy. Here are three articles in the Jewish Observer. An Orthodox psychotherapist confesses, must the Torah loyal therapist take all his cues from Dr. Freud, or may he enter the therapeutic process employing his own code of values? Evolution factor theory. So the attack of Darwin on traditional Judaism. People are of different minds, of course. A scientist finds the facts weak and the theory wanting, a credo of a scientist. Here you see this fellow in the first article, his bio. Interesting is how he offers it. Here, just looking at some of the authors, these are people who in their biographies, how they are signposted in the article shows their allegiance to a certain way of life. And when I speak about way of life, I always try to look at lived religion. Let's bring it down from, it's one thing to talk about rabbinic elites. I'm always interested to see how religious life is manifested to the rest of us. Before we get to there. So I like to look at these three items. One, and this is the transformation of American life and through refracted through the yeshiva world. So I'll give you three examples. Here in the New York Times, the 1970s, is an interesting report on the bracha bee, the popular spelling bee. Charles Schulz in the Peanut movie made it quite famous. The idea of transforming, taking this very American thing like the spelling bee and transforming it to a blessing bee, a bracha bee, through using the strategies of competition in an educational model, but making it a totally Jewish environment. Here in the late 1980s, actually out of Baltimore, was the emergence of today what we call Gedolim cards or Torah personality cards. It was actually an accountant out in Baltimore who started it. If our sons and daughters are collecting baseball cards, maybe we could influence them to not collect DiMaggio's and Mantles and Ken Griffey Jr.'s, but instead purchase and trade our favorite rabbis. And you have this young boy in Baltimore showing off. It's Shmuel Kamenetsky in the front. He's got doubles. Didn't notice that before. And then more recently, you have Binion Bucks. I think they don't sell these anymore. I have a few. If you take a look in Mishpacha Junior's magazine, what was the impetus to build these so-called kosher Legos? Building blocks of Binyan Box. One of my partners, says one of the founders of this curious institution, was building a shul out of Lego with his kids. And he realized that the pieces were really limited to what they allowed you to do. He approached me and said, let's create something that is Hamish, that Hamish kids, can enjoy. A lot of the Lego themes out there aren't so appropriate for frum kids. We wanted to create Legos that could be used to build the things that are most meaningful to us. We didn't have a lot of experience with manufacturing, so we joined forces with a neighbor of his who had experience with manufacturing in China. And we looked for a manufacturer who could create the Lego blocks to our specifications, and they built Lego Binyan blocks. So the idea that, but just before I go here, before I leave this page, the notion that in the yeshiva world, the transformation of American culture, not in total isolation, certainly, but to take some structures in America and build out, so to speak, an authentic, and I say this not in a, not necessarily to say that it is the right way, but to create something that feels right, an emotional authenticity of an American Orthodox Judaism. Want to make sure also that you see that the ramifications and the repercussions of certain notions within the yeshiva world has some consequences. Take the Pew study. This was drawn from the 2013, but the 2020 update study, the results bear out very, very similarly. Question J5, if you were interviewed by the Pew Report on Jewish American Life, you asked about the importance of intellectual curiosity to Jewishness. If you take a look on the top left, you'll see that all Jews, of all Jews, about 50 considered intellectual curiosity to be an essential point of their Jewish consciousness, their Jewish identity. If you broke it down based on movement, conservative, Orthodox, and Reform, you see that the Orthodox believe that intellectual curiosity is less essential to their Jewishness than do conservative and Reform Jews. But, I actually mentioned this last week, because in the Pew study, if you were asked if you're Orthodox, then asked more deeply, what type of Orthodoxy are you? Are you modern Orthodox, Hasidic, or Yeshivish? Look how it, look at how it cross-tabbed. So this is on the bottom left. Orthodoxy is here. This corresponds to this. Same exact chart. Same exact split bar. Modern Orthodoxy actually reported there even higher than conservative or reform. Almost 60% explained the modern Orthodox, explained that intellectual curiosity is an essential component of their Jewish consciousness, with Hasidic being very, very low, and Yeshivish being somewhere in the middle. And because Hasidic and Yeshivish populations are larger than modern Orthodox, the total Orthodox quotient that indicated that intellectual curiosity was essential was lower than conservative and reform, even though modern Orthodox outpaced both conservative and reform. What's interesting is that when you splice out Yeshivish, and you look at this, so this bar corresponds with this bar. It's about 37% suggest that intellectual curiosity is essential. The men reported about 20% essential, whereas the women reported similar to the modern Orthodox, meaning intellectual curiosity for so-called yeshivish or yeshiva world women, it actually outpaces both reform and conservative and is on pace with the modern Orthodox. You just take, I know there's a lot of numbers there. Show a nod. Does that all make sense? Okay, I'm seeing some. Okay, good. Again, just reporting the data. Which is that one of the repercussions, or one of the, I think, unanticipated determinants of change was the role of women's education in the yeshiva world. And so if you take a look, this is out of Portland, Oregon, in which there was a case that there was, I think it was a divorce case, I believe, in which the lawyers wanted to ask the wives of the Kollel community, one or two of them, I believe, to report on a particular thorny, a custody battle or some divorce proceedings. I forget exactly which one it was. And the women claimed, and this was upheld, they did not have to take the stand, because the information given to them pertaining to this particular case was protected by clerical privilege or rabbinic confidentiality. This was a challenging case, remarked Mr. Kurtzman. In an interview with the Atene Amani, Shi World newspaper, we were seeking to defend the Rebbetzin's right to claim clergy privilege without redefining the term Rebbetzin or misrepresenting the Masorah. We'll continue. Mr. Kurtzman agreed with Rabbi Fisher that it is reasonable to argue that despite Orthodoxy's position that women cannot be ordained rabbis, the Kollel wives were in fact officially hired by the Kollel to, quote-unquote, minister to the community in crucial ways that overlap with the duties of clergy. Ordainment, not sure if that's a word either, smicha, is about halacha, applicable to men exclusively. While women have no authority in that area, we were determined to prove that they do have the authority under Orthodox Judaism to educate, guide, and inspire, especially regarding family and marriage issues. From the OU responsum about women's leadership, founded, furnished a number of years ago by leading mostly Yeshiva University and OU Rosh Yeshiva. The idea of Masorah is often mistaken as a mere historical record of Jewish practice. That misunderstanding, combined with both the absence of historical uniformity of normative practice and the gradual evolution of halacha, can be misconstrued as compromising the authenticity, word I like very much, of Masorah. I think Masorah is rather an appreciation for and application of tradition as the guide by which new ideas, challenges, and circumstances are navigated. So what's interesting, I'll close with this, is that because of the construct of the yeshiva world, women, and this is why Beis Yaakov is so important, in the yeshiva world, were somehow removed from Das Torah and rabbinic authority, but at the same time, even though certainly in that community, women are not known or not given rabbinic titles. At the same time, it's a matter of titles. Their roles, though, are, this would be a good argued, in protecting these women in Portland a number of years ago in this case, they are bound by the same clerical privilege as their husbands were. And so the consequences and repercussions of history and how the yeshiva world builds it out has severe implications for not just America's legal arena, but really the social atmosphere as well. In the same way that Rav Aaron Cutler certainly meant to separate his yeshiva world from America, recall what I read with you about college, nevertheless his successors are still looking at curious ways of synthesizing the two, whether it be with Legos or baseball cards or bracha bees instead of spelling bees or even women's leadership. The yeshiva world, make no mistake about it, is still grappling with the same forces that all of us are in the United States. How it impacts and what they do with it are the consequences of maybe political science, but I argue for history in some way that therefore using this compass, using this lens to understand the yeshiva world is quite interesting. And it really therefore does redound a certain way on that original vision, whether he said it or not, of Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin. The Torah will have to make its way to the United States before the Messiah. How that plays out, I don't know. But certainly, how Torah migrated to the United States cannot help but be influenced by the contours, the curious contours, of American life. Thank you very much. So I saw there were a couple of questions. Happy to field them. You'll have it again. You're on mute.
Okay, this is not really a question, but I just wanted to highlight another connection between the Beis Yaakov movement and the yeshiva world, the rise of the yeshiva world as Rav Aaron envisioned it. So I think another reason why it was absolutely essential, as you demonstrate in that little article, is that the Beis Yaakov movement after the war in America implanted in the girls that were going through it, the number one, the importance of Torah besides the Torah mitzvahs, so pure Torah learning and the privilege it is to join in marriage with someone who has devoted his life, whether it's for 5 years, 10 years, or forever, to learning. So without having this cohort of girls graduating and willing to marry those boys who dedicated their lives, which was very unusual back in the 50s and 60s, to pure learning, then the whole thing would have crumbled. Because so that I just thought was...
Well, certainly, and even today we're seeing, although it's changing a little bit, we're seeing the avenues and creativity of finding college pathways or higher ed pathways for women. Men now are finding a path forward as well, but certainly that whole industry was carved out on behalf of women to earn and support. You know, certainly. Again, I don't offer an opinion here. I'm really just trying to understand.
Right. And I think there's some, because I was doing some research on the Basiakov movement at one point, so I think there is actually, this was articulated by some of the Basiakov leaders. But okay, I just wanted to point that out. So regarding the intellectual curiosity of among yeshivish women, speaking as a yeshivish woman, so I think I see there is a clear difference in the Beis Yaakov movement as opposed to the same brothers who go to a yeshiva. The girls are offered a much wider secular education and allowed perhaps to question more. That's just, I think part of that is because the Beis Yaakov movement was also established, not just by Sarah Schneer, but in conjunction with the German Orthodox teachers who put in a stream of that intellectualness gotten from Rav Hirsch, that openness to, science, et cetera, which the boys did not get. So I think that might, in my humble opinion, I think, I haven't done a study of this, but I think this might contribute to that.
Like, I think you're absolutely, I think you're on. Yeah, I think absolutely.
I would like to say something about that. I think the Beis Yaakov movement before the Holocaust was, as you said, very influenced by the German stream of thinking, and it changed very much in America. And I think that was partially influenced by Rabbi Aaron Cutler and the Yeshiva movement. I don't think the Beis Yaakov post-war was, there was a significant change from the Beis Yaakov pre-war.
That's true, but it's still there. And a lower, yes, I totally agree with you, but you still have that, they couldn't squash it totally. It's still there.
Right. Yes, yes, yes. I agree with that.
All right. Some other questions. Yeah. But, when Leslie Klein's book comes out, all the debates will be settled.
I wonder whether you could tell me whether you think the story about Reb Aaron and Reb Moshe, looking into the Pasuk in the Torah, whether that's an authentic story or just a legend.
I'll take that and then I'm going to call on Suzanne afterwards. I'm not familiar with the story.
Oh, well, the reason why Reb Aaron went to America is because echoing the way that Moshe Rabbeinu joined.
Right. Yes. Yes. It's another legend to study. I don't know. I have to get back to you.
Yeah.
I have to get back to you about where we see it to trace it. Yes.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know if you mentioned it, but if you did, I missed it. When was that concept of Das Torah first mentioned?
Articulated. Yeah. Where was it? Where does it come from? So a number of scholars. Larry Kaplan has written about it. Yaakov Katz, yeah. Jacob Katz wrote about it. I wrote an article with Seth Farr. If you Google in my academia page, I wrote an anti-modernism. And Zev Elif, Seth Farber, you'll find the article. And I have all the sources there. Like anything, it happens over a period of time. Some people, and I don't think they're right, want to suggest it was inspired by the emergence of papal infallibility in the 1870s. I don't think the two have necessarily one to do with one another. Some people will suggest it goes all the way back to Moses. But I give you the sources there.
But
of course, what do you do when they're competing Das Torahs? That's
can you give me a ballpark date?
Oh, I think most agree that the notion in its fullest understanding now is the mid-20th century. Kazanish, Briskerov, certainly. Shelley, yes.
What I don't understand is why in some cases is it all right to take things from the goyim in quotation marks and like the rabbi cards or the Legos or something like that, and in other cases things that seem very, very neutral, you couldn't possibly put on. It's not part of the goyim do it, and so even if it looks okay, can't do it. So when is what is the rationale okay? For certain times being okay?
So, and I hope people understand, I'm not making this comparison out of slight. I look at it in terms of methodology, is that if you look at scholars of the Amish, they use a term called bargaining with modernity. So, for example, according to many Amish, because of history, a lawnmower of any type is not able to be used, but a weed whacker, so long as you remove the motor, is okay. For some Amish, you can't drive in a car, but you can have somebody drive you. You can, if you're working, because there's a limit now to the number of people in the Amish community that can farm or build with wood. So many have to get jobs, and so they have to use an iPad or other technologies on a work site, but they leave it at home. This idea of bargaining with modernity is shaped by history and is shaped by predicament. And so when and how this, what Sylvia Fishman, another teacher of mine, calls coalescence, when it happens and how it happens, and what it looks like. The example that I've written about that gets everybody up in arms is the use of peanut oil on Passover. You can't find it. And yet quinoa has at this point become a staple in Passover cuisine. There is no reason. The same arguments against peanuts and peanut oil is the same on quinoa, but they took place different times with the migration of the Hungarian folkway to the United States. So historians like to embrace the messiness. I know that the rest of us do not. We want saliency, but historians look at the contingencies of history, and we're okay. We're okay with understanding that time and place make a difference. Time for a few more. I don't know if that was a hand up, but I'm happy to take maybe two more questions if need be.
I'd like to ask a question, but before I do, let me explain that my voice is distorted because I have to apologize. My question is a very basic question. Can you give me an idea how demographically the breakup of the Orthodox community between, let's say, modern Orthodox and everybody else, it changed over time? And my second question, and a comment. I grew up in Toronto, although I live in New York, and I'm very much a Torontonian.
Okay.
When I grew up here, deans of arts in the university were Orthodox Jews, and my mentor, who I learned economics with, was also an Orthodox Jew. And so, I'm not sure that can happen.
So I know less about the Toronto situation. Certainly I can say Canada has always had a traditional religious bent to it, Jewish or otherwise. With America, according to the Pew study, There are essentially, what we understand today is that there are about 5 million Jews in the United States. Brandeis has it around 7 million, but it's probably around 5 million. And about 30% identify as modern Orthodox of the, or excuse me, I skipped a step. Of the 5 million, 10% are Orthodox, about 500,000 in America. And about 30% of that, about 150,000, which basically means that when Rabbi Eli Sinner of Frisch says that he's educating 10% of the modern Orthodox community every year at a time, he may well be. About 70% of the Orthodox community are part of the yeshiva or the Hasidic world. So certainly we've seen that change over a period.
That's amazing. I would never thought it would be that high.
Yeah, those are numbers. All right, Jay, I see that you came up. So maybe Jay's telling me to close it out.
No, I'm not. I am not. I just think I were a place where I could, out of the
sun. Oh, now you're okay. All right.
Yeah, so maybe, yes. No, no, I mean, I can go on. And I think there were a few comments in the chat box.
Oh, sorry.
You got to all of the comments in the chat box. Yeah. You want to take a quick look. While you're looking at the chat box, I'll just announce, and we'll send out an email. Rabbi Shulman's class tomorrow, because of Shiva Asar B'Tammuz, and he's in Israel, and the fast is going to end around 8-something, and that's when he gives, that would be his normal time for giving. The class is going to be an hour earlier. So I'll send an email, but Rabbi Shulman's class tomorrow will be at noon Eastern, 7 p.m. Israeli time. So even if you're in Israel, you can come, and then the fast will end just after that. Wednesday morning, Rabbi Tzvi Grumet is starting a three-part series on the poetry of mourning. So that will be Wednesday morning, 10 a.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. in Israel, whatever, 7 a.m. on the West Coast, you know, all those times. That's where Tzvi Grumet is very good. He's spoken a few times for us, so that'll be on the poetry of mourning. I think we sent that email the other day. Okay, Zev, I gave you enough time to read over all the comments.
Yeah, well, actually, I encourage everybody to read the comments. They're wonderful, more in the Kamot, so to speak. Certainly, there's a wonderful Feldheim biography of Vishnu Kaplan. There are Naomi Seidman's written a wonderful biography of Sarah Schneer. It's the most important biography, certainly. Yeah, mostly wonderful comments. Maybe one more question.
Can I ask a question?
Please. Rabbi Siegel, you have the floor. Last one.
Thank you so much. I asked it on the chat. I was wondering, you know, Slobodka was a very elitist kind of yeshiva. What was their approach towards secular studies? I can't imagine they didn't want them to know anything.
Yeah, Slobodka's founded in the latter quarter of the 19th century in the spirit of the Musar movement, understanding that a solution should not be general studies, secular studies, college, but should be Gadlut HaAdam. That was one of two strands, but that there, the sort of, if there has to be a Torah and, it should be Torah and Musar. Now, famously, Reb Chaim Brisker, when asked whether a Musar Shmuz or a Mashgiach should be introduced to Volozhin, he responded, the best Musar is a Blad of Gemara. And we know that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was somewhere negative to ambivalent, depending on the situation, about general studies. And that was critical. Mm-hmm. It's a good question. And the fact that Slobodka gained a foothold, a very sturdy foothold in North America, is really important. The number, particularly in Chicago and elsewhere, the emergence of America as sort of a satellite of the culture of Slobodka was integral. And in fact, unfortunately, in the Hebron Massacre, that's where Slobodka traveled.
Right.
There were a number of Americans who were studying there.
Right. I'll just make one comment. You know, Professor Saul Lieberman, who emerged out of Slobodka, and others, he wasn't the only one, but I give him just as one example, was an expert in Greek philosophy. And there were others who were also, experts in those kinds of ancillary subjects that were beyond Torah.
Correct. And at the same time, Ron Cutler studied for a bit in Slobodka. So did Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and that that whole class of elite Rosh Yeshiva also passed through. So Slobodka, like Volozhin, like any yeshiva, has a way of furnishing a cornucopia of opinion, but certainly.
Right. And the question, by the way, about Rav Gifter and his first cousin, Rabbi Judah Nadich, you know, from Park Avenue Synagogue, do you know at all if they had any relationship or they didn't talk to each other? Or
I'll have to look into it. Send me a note and see if I can dig up the app.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it. Chazak baruch.
Chazak baruch. All right. Until next week, everybody. We'll jump to the 1980s.
Okay. Thank you. Next week, patrilineal descent, correct?
Yes.
Right, Dr. Deb? Yeah, patrilineal descent next week. Okay.
I
look forward to being with you. Everybody, be well and b'sarot tovot. Thank you.
Bye-bye.